Okay, at least we got podcasts since Echo's misbehaving. And let's see what we got on the webpage. In case you can't find it, or you didn't get that email. Did the rest of you get it now?
Mm-hmm.
No? Did all came? Oh, okay. So I don't have to go to the webpage, I guess. But just to show you something fun. It'll pop up that it's teaching. So if you go to teaching, then you got this webpage, Debski's class right there. And we just put up some fun work from before when we worked on synaptic properties, all right? So you can show your parents you're actually working and developing synapses, all right? Okay, so that's kind of cool. So on that webpage, though, what you have is a PowerPoint, a PDF, and a little worksheet we're going to go through today, and I'll... Well, Echo's not functioning, but at least I'll put the podcast and you have the PowerPoint file. So you can put the two together, all right? I don't know if it's misfunctioning. But anyways, we have a lot of exciting things to do today. And what we want to do is to think about where we left off. Jim Geddes, Dr. Geddes talked to you before about development, wrapping up development. And you remember what we talked about before with synaptic transmission and synapses and how complex the synapse is. Lots of proteins in the presynaptic nerve terminal. Lots of proteins on the postsynaptic cell that responds to holding those receptors there, right? And, I mean, new papers are coming out every day in this field. If you look up in PubMed or just go Journal of Neurophysiology, there's even a whole journal called Synapse. I mean, isn't that amazing? A journal Synapse every month. A journal comes out just on synaptic properties. So there's a ton of information out there. And one of the latest things that came out is actually showing that glutamate receptors might form dimers and it might change their function, and then they separate and they respond differently to the glutamate, and that this happens inside of synapses and then moves around outside the synapse, and it might change the whole properties of how you respond to glutamate. And there's just tons of interesting aspects out there. Anybody get the book, Brain on Fire? Brain on Fire. Shameful. Shameful, shameful. So write to your parents and tell them it's a required textbook, and that way they'll send it to you. You know, get it at Amazon. It's one way to get your books. My kids use that scam all the time. Sometimes I wonder if it really relates to academics. But anyways, so let's go through a little bit more about synaptic transmission. And some of it is a little bit of a review, but we're going to hit it in different aspects and understand the synapse and do a little quantification study here and see what you how you feel about this and some discussion. But I think this is really quite interesting. So we want to go through a process called quantile analysis and indexing synaptic transmission. Remember, anything in biology, if you can't put it in mathematical terms and you can't describe it in mathematical functions, then you really haven't done the science yet. It doesn't matter what biological process you're talking about. Until you can index it, like glucose levels up, down, right, pathology, physiology, it all has to be, you know, where's your normal range and where's the abnormal range? So you need some values to it. Just like growth or hormonal levels or anything, you have to put a number to it, right? So if we don't have the mathematics for anything in biology, then we haven't any topics about it. We haven't finished the process yet, and we need to find out ways to quantify it with numbers. And it's the same with synaptic transmission. So let's look a little bit about synapse, and I just want to draw, kind of go over some history a little bit, and then for some of you have this in 350, but we're going to get it in kind of quickly and then go through some particular topics that I think would be fun. We have to go back to, I think I put it on the slide. Let's see. Back to what was over here. Well, that's interesting. Is anything going to work on the slide today? I might have to switch over to this thing. I think there's something wrong with my computer. Good thing we put it on the web, too. Let me get this up here. Something's wrong with my laptop. So think about synapse and how they measured synaptic function. Okay. I don't need this thing anymore, so it's not working. So let's go through this, and then we'll come up and see what's happening with this computer. Let's go back to 1954, where they started to work on synaptic preparations. And one of the first preparations that was actually used was actually on your first your first love of animals. What was it? The crayfish, right? The crayfish. And it was actually the crayfish preparation, and then they went on to the frog neuromuscular junction. Now, why would they use the crayfish preparation? Any of you had 350 before reasons for it, like your lab? Why do you use the crayfish preparation? Or why do you think that preparation was used so well in understanding many properties?
Easy to work with.
Easy to work with, maintained very well. You can set it open, put minimal saline on, just salts in it, you know, half a day. It's really easy to work with, right? And you didn't need any large preparation. A few motor neurons, easy to dissect. Well, it was pretty much the same with the frog preparation. If you go back in the history about when they were using the frog prep, really Sidney Ringer came up with a saline that could be used to actually keep hearts going in a frog heart. And that's what he worked with. And it's the Ringer saline that you have today, or you hear about today, that is for an IV drip, basically, Ringer saline. But it, you know, it's a changed bit for humans, right, and modified over the years. But basically, Sidney Ringer was working with frogs and working with the heart, and he came up with a saline that kept the heart going pretty well. And some of it was just by serendipity and an accident finding out about calcium actually being important for maintaining the heart. But when you came up with that saline, then they could use it on other preparations. And that's actually how the neuromuscular junction preparation became more utilized in the frog preparations. And people could do dissections and work with those preparations as well. And amphibian preps look pretty well also. So let's just think about that frog neuromuscular junction, for example, and the synaptic properties to understand the synapse and how to quantify it. So here's a nerve terminal, and these are vesicles. And let's just think about that. You know, an action potential comes down, opens up the calcium channels, as we talked about. And then what happens? A lot of vesicles fuse and release transmitter. And if you had an intracellular electrode, Bernard Katz actually started off with an extracellular electrode. Intracellular electrodes only came around in the late 50s, early 60s. So let's think about, well, let's go with the outside electrode like he had. Okay, he had an extracellular electrode filled up with KCL, actually, and he moved that around the preparation, around the neuromuscular junction. And what he found in this kind of recording, if he stimulated the nerve, he could then record a big response, right, in a muscle fiber. So this is the muscle fiber. If he moved away from it, the neuromuscular junction over here to the side, he found something else. So this is moving away. He found not so much this little bump right here, but he just found the rise. And so that was kind of interesting. If he got around the neuromuscular junction, he saw this gradual depolarization and then the action potential on the muscle fiber. So on frog, like your muscles, they produce action potentials, your skeletal muscles. Right? So this was the threshold for activating the action potential on the muscle. So that was kind of interesting to him, that he found these differences. So what did he do to understand more about this preparation, understanding synapses? He lowered the calcium. Because remember, calcium was important to come in the nerve terminal. So if he lowered the calcium, decreased the calcium levels, then he would see something like this instead. He would see these kind of graded responses. Okay? And he might not see an action potential at all far away. He might actually see just a small depolarization, but that it decremented pretty much as you go away from the neuromuscular junction, right, the neuromuscular junction. Well, some other experiments that he did, he played with this, and he varied his calcium levels, you know, really low or just enough. And what he found out is if he played with it, he could get even a smaller one or a smaller one, something like that. And if he raises the calcium back up, he would get the threshold and boom, get an action potential. So he knew calcium was very important. Actually, the person in his lab that discovered that was T.P. Fang from China. He really doesn't get the credit for this, but T.P. Fang should have got a Nobel Prize, and he did. But he actually, T.P. Fang was the one that described it as a calcium that was important for this in his experiments. So that was interesting. It depended on calcium, and that there was something very unique about that threshold. They had already been working on squid axons and understanding that you go up to a certain depolarization and boom, you got an action potential of a squid. And the same guy, Katz, Bernard Katz, he got a Nobel Prize for basically the shape of the action potential. He worked on a squid preparation in this, so he could put the two together and realize, oh, we're getting action potentials in the muscle fiber. So what else did he do experimentally? Well, instead of using calcium or lowering the calcium, he could raise the magnesium. And magnesium will block the calcium channels. So it's basically like lowering the calcium. And he went through these same kind of experiments. If he raises magnesium up really high, very high, then he would have small responses here, right? Because he blocked more calcium channels. And if he just had a little bit of magnesium, he could get some of those calcium channels to work and he could get a bit higher response. And if he went away from the neuromuscular junction, everything was great, you know, graded, so they were really smaller events that were farther moved away from the neuromuscular junction itself. Well, he found that was really quite interesting. And then, without stimulation now, so you don't stimulate, you're not stimulating the nerve terminal, but you just record. And you just record around the neuromuscular junction, so this is just recording, so without stimulation of the nerve. If he recorded right over the neuromuscular junction and just kept it there, his electrode, all of a sudden he would find these things. All right? And this is much amplified. Think of this maybe like one or two millivolts, okay, up here. The amplitude of that. This is maybe one millivolt here. One millivolt in amplitude, okay? So he could find that. If he moved over to the side, away from the neuromuscular junction, moved over here, he would see these, but much smaller. You'd kind of get lost in the noise, you know, because you have a noisy trace. So he realized, hey, there's something unique about being under the neuromuscular junction. And even without stimulating, he found some kind of depolarization going on, a current that he could measure around the neuromuscular junction. But when he went away from it, it was very small. Just like when he stimulated the neuromuscular junction sub-threshold, he got the same response. So he thought, well, this is really neat. You know, something's happening at the neuromuscular junction even when I don't stimulate. So he thought, well, why don't I quantify this and begin to understand what's going on? So he took the amplitude of these, he measured the amplitude of these events, of what he could, and he plotted the amplitude of what we call spontaneous events, or also called minis. So in the literature, these are called spontaneous events or minis. So he plotted these minis, and he got something like this. So these are the minis, and he would, you know, I'm just doing a histogram. Depends on how many he recorded, how long he kept the recording going, but you get the idea. And so this is the number of occurrences, and this is the size, or amplitude. All right, and this is about 1 millivolt here. All right, and if you drew a curve to that, you would see it kind of has a gamma distribution, a bit to the right shift. So that was interesting, and he thought, well, why don't I plot the evoked responses that were sub-thresholds also? So let's plot the evoked responses that were sub-thresholds. So now he looked at the evoked responses when he's stimulating. Okay, so again, the frequency. And he would do this, you know, 100,000 times, right? You keep stimulating the nerve, and you see this little fluctuation going up and down. Now, if he had more calcium, he got bigger responses. If he had less calcium, he had smaller amplitude responses, right? So he's still measuring the amplitude of the responses. So let's say he had a lot of calcium to begin with. All right, so this is the amplitudes. So if he had, let's do one here, and two here, and three here. So if he had a lot of calcium around, guess, can everybody see that okay? Yes, even with this thing blocking your way, possibly. Let me see what this thing is doing. What's this thing? thing even going to work? I mean, let me find PowerPoint here. 1 second. All programs. Come on. Very slow. Restart the computer. No, restart it. Microsoft Office. PowerPoint. Okay, here we go. And let me just open this. Oh my God. Crazy. So we're back to the evoked responses. And let's see, can you see that now? Hopefully you can. All right. If he had a lot of calcium, he'd get responses like this. So this is with high calcium. I mean, just, but still subthreshold. If he lowered the calcium, what do you think would happen to this distribution? If he lowers the calcium, he has a different response. He got the smaller responses. So if, let's think about, if he lowered the calcium, he got something like this. Maybe about the same. But then he only had a few of these. Okay? So then a different distribution. You get the idea. So it would shift depending on what calcium he used or the amount of magnesium. But what he found out was that the average values in these distributions, it's about 1 millivolt here, 2 millivolts here, 3 millivolts here. And so he said, hey, that's kind of odd. It's coming in these units, and I over-exaggerated here, and it looks like the same distribution that was here with the spontaneous events, the minis. So he said, hey, I bet these spontaneous events make up the evoked responses. And so this is when he came up with the quantum hypothesis. All right, so this is what's still held today in understanding synaptic transmission. Oh my God, the whole computer shut up up here. Did I turn on? There we go. So that was kind of neat discovery. And from that, this is where we still are today in understanding synaptic transmission. Now, there's some studies that are trying to understand how do you index synaptic transmission? How are you going to put a number to this synapse? Let's say this is a synapse, and you want to understand that this new drug is going to enhance synaptic transmission. Let's say, you know, people are, the nervous system is not working right, and you need to enhance it. Maybe they're having too much anesthetic or something, and you want to try to get them back up again, you know, get their brain active. Or maybe you want to induce a coma in some way and shut down the nervous system. You don't want it too active, right? Maybe there's different reasons. Or maybe you want, maybe somebody has spasticity in their skeletal muscle, and you want to decrease it. How do you know how much to decrease it? What level of drug should you give? Or there's a genetic defect, and you want to characterize the synaptic transmission of the genetic defect, and you want to put a number to it, like how severe it is, so you can test it around the world, and anybody could read numbers, right? They use it the same way. So how are we going to index synaptic transmission? Any ideas from y'all?
What would you do? NIH is going to give you $1 million, and how are you going to index synaptic transmission, maybe try out this new drug. Let's say you're working for a pharmaceutical company. Are you interested in neuroscience and you're a neurologist out there and you're wanting to characterize this person's problems so you could describe it and write up a paper and get your cover issue in Journal of Neurology? Any ideas? What do you think you might do? It could be on a mouse model. Say maybe you have a mouse model that you can work with. Right. Or you want to test that new drug out, and you use the frog neuromuscular junction to test it out. So, you know, it doesn't have to be the human, but you're testing out the drug in the frog neuromuscular junction. How do we quantify synaptic transmission? How do we put a number to it? Any ideas?
maybe count what you think happened. You know, if you want to see its sensitivity to what? Calcium, right? Maybe you could lower the calcium and find out if it's more sensitive or less sensitive to calcium. Maybe the evoke responses, even though this is an action potential, but maybe there's something wrong with the muscle fiber. Maybe it doesn't make an action potential. Maybe there's something wrong with the sodium channels on the muscle fibers, right? And the muscle's not responding, but the nerve's completely working fine. So with these neuromuscular disorders, what do you have to do? You have to think about presynaptic components. You have to think about postsynaptic components, right? You have to think about, for example, how does the target, like the muscle, which is a model for synaptic transmission, even in our brain, it's a model system that's used to understand the basics of synaptic transmission. We'd have to find out, is it post? Is it pre? Maybe if it's post, the action potential, it might have reached threshold, but maybe it's smaller, right? Maybe we're not opening up as many sodium channels. Maybe there's a defect in the numbers of the distribution of sodium voltage gate sodium channels. How about if there's some defect in the receptors? So maybe there's not enough receptors, right? Remember we talked about that one disease the very first day, Eaton-Lambert syndrome, that little cancer that you can get in your lung, and then you start to get muscle weakness. It's making antibodies against your acetylcholine receptors, and you start to get weak, tripped, and when they check it now, they say, do a blood check, they find that, oh, you got antibodies for Eaton-Lambert, or your acetylcholine receptors, and they look around and find this tumor and take it out, and all of a sudden, you're better, and it's dissolving, right? But these things happen. Let's say if you wanted to characterize it better, maybe there's some treatment you can give in the meantime. Right? What would you think would happen if you started making antibodies to your acetylcholine receptors? What do you think is going to happen to the response here? All at once. Okay. So, any ideas? We're doing caffeine infusion in the office. Maybe. Where do these responses come from? These minis. These come from single vesicle responses, right? The vesicles fusing. Spontaneous fusion of these vesicles, when you're not even stimulating, makes up these minis. The quantum, and I guess I jumped ahead of time trying to fix the computer, the quantum is the single vesicle response, right? And the quantum of why you get greater ones, it's more vesicles that fuse to give rise to, say, 2 units or 3 units, 3 vesicles, right? But a single vesicle is here. Okay, so you might expect, what, some smaller responses maybe in here? If it's a postsynaptic phenomenon, right? So you can maybe measure the amplitudes of these, but it still doesn't tell you a number of synaptic properties, right? You might have an idea that the postsynaptic cell is not as responsive. But then again, if you have a smaller mini, what could that be due to? Maybe it's not really the receptor density. Maybe the packaging inside the vesicle. Maybe you're not packaging the transmitter very well inside the vesicle. Maybe that's the problem. And remember, the packaging comes from what? Transporters on the vesicle, right? The package in it. But where do these chemicals come from? The transmitters that are in the cytoplasm here to get packaged. Sometimes retaken back up. So maybe it's a transporter problem on the plasma membrane, not the vesicle transporter. There are drugs like antibiotics that actually block the vesicle transport. Maybe this, this condition, you could look at an antibiotic side effect, and it blocks this packaging, but not that packaging. Not the transport bringing the plasma membrane, but the packaging inside the vesicle. So that's why some of the antibiotics, like delphamycin, mycines, right? A lot of drugs, mycine antibiotics, but they're taken off the market because they cause too many side effects neurologically and in synaptic transmission. Then they quantified it. People in pharmaceutical companies trying to figure out what the problem was. And they found that it was blocking this transporter and it was the transport. So it's a side effect that you wouldn't want. So people in these labs are actually the ones doing all this quantification and doing the real physiology so clinicians and healthcare workers can utilize these medications. But they have to understand all these properties and understand these too to quantify synapses. So think about what might you want to do. You might want to understand, a first approach. You can do all these kind of studies, but then you realize there's many other aspects. It might not just be post. It might be pre. It might be a combination of the two. There's a term called mean quantal content to try to find out what on average how the synapses function on average. So mean quantum content is to relate to counting how many vesicles would fuse over a period of time when you stimulate it. And understanding then that's the kind of an index of synaptic strength or synaptic efficacy. So that's what people have used. And to try to understand that, people have used models to understand lots of disorders. You can think about paralysis in the face. Is it the nerve? Is it the muscle problems? And they use a number of different preparations. Frog is a big one. Now a lot with transgenics in mice and rats, but also your favorite little guy over here, the crayfish. And Drosophila is becoming much more prevalent to be used because you have the power of genetics and you can make specific protein knockdowns or overexpression or receptor modifications on the muscle fiber. So there's lots of disorders, muscle disorders that are now neuromuscular disorders modeled in crayfish, in flies. And you can even use a little larval preparation as well and look at behaviors with it. So let's think back of that synapse. Remember that synapse? Vesicles fusing to the membrane, releasing that transmitter, and now we want to quantify this somehow. So remember all those proteins that we talked about in that last, our first class period, and we talked about many of them, but these were just a few that could hold that vesicle, there and wait for calcium to come in and cause a fusion process, and then it can pinch back off and refill and repackage and redock again. And so you think about all the problems with these proteins. How does botulinum work? Anybody? Botox injections? Anybody ever hear about Botox injections?
For example, doesn't it cut snap protein?
Yeah, it cuts these particular proteins, right? And it's interesting, then they can't fuse, so the nerve terminal is not functioning anymore. How long does it take for that synapse to come back functional again? Look that up. See if you can find a paper where actually they talk about the particular synapse coming back into function again after Botox treatment. Well, the Botox treatment at first, it depresses synaptic transmission, so you might not have crow's feet, for example. People do that so they don't have wrinkles. But also it's used for more important things like blepharospasm if your eyes keep twitching too much, or maybe you have laryngeal spasm. They can inject in there and actually stop that instead of just cosmetic problems. But the problem is the nerve terminal in time starts to branch and starts to sprout, and you get even stronger synapses in time, so you have to kind of keep doing this. But these are basic properties that have that we're talking about that are really important to understand how long this would treatment would work, and then what would happen in time. Would that synapse ever come back again? So this work with Bernard Katz, he came up with ways to quantify the synaptic transmission. And let's just look at these two terminals, these two responses for a second here, and think about how you might quantify this, like we were just talking about. Now, these are flipped. These are actually measuring currents into the muscle cell. So they're a little bit different than what you're used to in your textbooks, so showing the depolarization. This is current, like sodium current going into the cell, okay? But it's the same idea. Here is an evoked response. This is a stimulus in the bath. In this artifact, then the action potential down the nerve terminal, and then the vesicles fuse, and boom, you get all this current to come in. And then you just wait, and then every once in a while you get a spontaneous event. Up here at this particular neuromuscular junction, you stimulate, you get the artifact, the action potential comes down, and boom, boom, you had two events happen, and we don't see any minis there. Let's say this mini is the same size in both of these. How to quantify these two different types of terminals? There are two different terminals. So how are we going to quantify these, do you think? This is what Bernard Katz dealt with in 1950s. So we can go back to the 1950s. We're sitting at his desk. Think about yourself in his shoes. How is he going to characterize this? And he's probably the only one in the world that's really focused right now on understanding synaptic transmission. He's making world breakthroughs in understanding synaptic transmission. So everybody, all the eyes are on you, thinking about how are you going to do this? How are you going to figure this out? What are you going to do? Run, hide, pull the covers over? No. What are we going to do? We're going to try to figure this out, right? Any ideas? Good God. What you might think about? Let me shut that thing off. What would we do? Come on. You're smart. You're smart as Bernard Katz.
Can you read the question one more time?
How are you going to maybe characterize
synaptic transmission or how to index this? How are you going to put numbers to this? I mean, what might you do, knowing these kind of different things that we've come up with? We can come up with answers, but you're trying to figure out how strong the synapse is. Synaptic strength. Strength.
Like add up each response and then correlate each response to, well, so like you see like there's a number two there, so that's like that's one response, but it's like times two.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that for however, like how strong the response is, and multiply by that factor of how strong it is, and then divide it by the total number of responses.
Yes, similar, very similar, and that's what some of they came up with. So in this nerve preparation, it would actually stimulate it and see how many responses you got. And here you got one, two, right? And you do it again, and the next time you might have one. And then do it again, the next time you might have three, right? You might have one, two, three, right? And you do it again, maybe nothing. So you do it 1,000 times, let's say. You stimulate that nerve and you're recording. Stimulate it, record. And you count. Basically ones and twos and threes. And you come up with this kind of measure. The sum of the failures times zero, so because there's failures, numbers of single events that you could see as a single event times one, the number of doubles times two, and so on and so on. And then the number of times you're stimulated. So what do you get at the end of that? You get a mean quantile content. Remember the single vesicle, which is responding to these, you get an average number of vesicles that you evoked to cause, you know, transmission, right? And you could pick those up. So it's on just on average. It's like flipping a coin. You know, how many times did you get heads and tails, right? And so you could actually calculate that. And so that's really neat. But how do you do it when you have a preparation like this or a response like this? You can't count really very well how many quantile events are in this, right? You can't see just one or two. So what might you come up with to analyze this type of response? And it's much like what Bernard Katz was faced with when he didn't have, you know, the single events the same size of the minis, but he had these bigger events. It's the same idea. So what might you do there? Well, we know the size of a mini. What might we do? We know that's a single quantile event. We know this is still sub-threshold. Yes. Maybe figure out the area of this or the area of this, divide this into there, or the peak amplitude, right? So we get into that, and we have another way of measuring. You can measure the amplitude of these quantile events, and you can measure the mean amplitude or area, so either area and area, of the spontaneous events, right? And divide this into that. And now you have an average of how many quanta were released every time you stimulate it. And again, you do the 1,000 runs, and you get an on average. It's not for each, you know, single stimulus, but on average, how well that synapse is functioning. If the number goes up, synaptic efficacy goes up. If the number goes down, synaptic efficacy goes down. Your drug does this, or your drug does that, right? So you can actually quantify synaptic transmission. So you can see the problem with the counts, and you might have to go to another method, such as this, to try to figure that out. And this is what Bernard Katz came up with in the 1950s. And you know, people are still using these same techniques that he came up with and originated back in the 50s. But people are also working on modifications of that that are really quite neat. So, we have something for y'all. And that is, well, I just wanted you to look at this other little thing, because the assumption with Bernard Katz's studies, or the way of an analyzing of this, is what? That the minis come from the same population of where the evoked responses are coming from. But what if the minis aren't coming from the same synaptic response, the same synapse right here that you're measuring your evoked responses, but maybe they're coming from, you know, something else or another region on the nerve terminal, and they're not in the same population as the evoked responses. That kind of throws off this whole analysis, right? And there are a number of papers that people have now shown that the minis, or the spontaneous events, aren't really the same population of vesicles as the evoked ones, which then you question the analysis, because it might be a different pool or a different response.
So the mean quantum content is just looking at the number of vesicles released?
Yes, on average.
Okay. So, and it doesn't take into account if the receptors are normal or less.
Okay.
And that's a, another big problem with this, is that if, well, if the evoked response, right, the receptor started decreasing in numbers, so your evoked response would decrease, and so would your minis, right? So the ratio comes up, you know, the evoked. But if it came from a different population, there might be differences in how they function. So there's some problems with this analysis as well, but it's kind of one of the better ones they have. And there are some, there is some controversy with this. So I have a little exercise, and hopefully we have time for this if we don't get too crazy in here. And I think it'll be fun. You can work together with this. I'll explain it in just a second. You can take this home. Show parents. Well, you're learning about neuroscience. We had to realize that was good. Sorry. But it's kind of fun, right? So let's look at this. If you need more, just begging for more. So let's look at this. So let's look at 10 runs, and each time we did it, we simulated, and we got these evoked responses. And you see the scale bar at the top? One box is 10 millivolts, all right? One box is 10 millivolts. And then we have over here minis, and I changed it just to make sure that you can see that this scale, I enlarge the scale. One box now is 1 millivolt. So those are 10 millivolts. This is 1 millivolt. Let's try to do a mean quantum content really quick. On average, you're estimating. All right. So what are you going to do? Just write a number next to each one of these. Like the box, you know that one box is 10. All right. Let's write your numbers there. What do you come up with? Or maybe a person next to you wants to do the minis, and you could do the evokes, for example. So write numbers next to the evoked responses, and then write numbers next to the minis. And we'll write the answers up here on the board. Anybody have some numbers, average number for the, maybe the evoked responses? Anybody? An average number on evoked? Numbers?
13.
13? All right. And so you got the individual numbers and then they divided by 10, right? Okay. And so some one person has 13. Anybody else have another number?
About
14. Okay. So 13 and 14, the other numbers. And you get the idea of doing that, right? Adding those numbers up and then dividing by 10. Okay. 13, 14? Everybody's in agreement? Right? 14.3, exactly. 14.3, okay. How about the minis? You went through and wrote numbers. Remember, that's 1 millivolt on those, so that's a 1. You might think of that as a half, right? This is 1 and 2, so 1, half, 2, 1, half.
I got 1.01.
1.01. Okay. Anybody else? Numbers?
1.
1, okay. Hearing other numbers about there, up in range, get the idea? Okay, so, which number should we take here to maybe do this, right? So this is exactly some of the issues, right? Different people are going to do this. But we just grossly estimated. You could do this on a computer today a lot easier, right? To measure the right amplitudes and have something probably out to 3 or 4 digits or something like that, right? And the same with the minis, right? So let's just take this on kind of midpoint between these two here. So 14 for the evoked divided by the mini average. So our mean quantum content, little m, is equal to 14, right? So on average, we had 14 vesicles fuse every time we stimulated, on average. On average. Some were smaller, some were larger, right? But on average, we did an average. Mean quantum content, the average area, or the amplitude of the evoked, divided by the average amplitude of the minis. And so you just came up with a way to index synaptic transmission that's still used in clinical research and pharmacological research that's being used today. What are some of the problems with this? Let's look at this particular synapse. Let's say this is in the brain slice, the hippocampal slice. It's a common problem in hippocampal slices because they can't record right under the neuromuscular junction, which you could do in the frog preparation or like a crayfish or a fly preparation. You're recording in a cell body over here, right? And let's say we stimulate this nerve here, and we're measuring these responses. Okay, so the evoked responses are coming down this dendrite and onto that cell body. Okay, so that's the evoked responses. Where are the minis coming from, though? The minis are not only coming from that synapse, but all the other synapses on this preparation, right? All the other synapses, and even the ones you did not stimulate. And here we have another one over here just to show you the idea. But there could be some way up here on the dendrites, some maybe down here in the dendrites, giving rise to larger responses, quantum responses, because of decay of the potential. So the problem with this analysis, like in the hippocampal world, or where you're poking a cell body and you're not right underneath the synapse, you don't know where the minis are coming from. Right? They might not be the same population of where you're stimulating, where the evoked responses are coming from. So how good is your analysis? Right? So some questions come up with these kind of things. And then let's think about why do you even have... So that we've went through this. This is a neat little exercise. So let's think about why do you even have variation in the quantum response? You remember those minis? Why do they vary? So if we can understand why they vary, maybe we can understand why we get variation in the evoked responses, that they're not always the same every time you stimulate it, too. All right. Is it more than just numbers of quantum events? Is it just not 1, 2, 3, but why do you have variation? So just to kind of rehash this, we have a vesicle fusing to the membrane, right? From the action potential coming down, calcium comes in, and then we get transmitter release. And let's say we're measuring in that postsynaptic cell. Now, this is current. You could flip this over. Don't be confused. You could flip it over and think of measuring membrane potential. But this is just like current flowing into the cell. And this is recording right underneath the synapse. All right, so we're recording right close to a synapse or in a muscle fiber, let's say, like in your preparation. So why might we get variation in the size of these? Why is it like even when he's poking it, so like during the muscle fiber, like Bernard Katz was doing, and he had all these parts that you just showed on that piece of paper where you got variation, right? So what's the quanta from?
You have variation from things like how much is being taken up by cells around it, or if you've got like a suitable menstruation
in the clavicle. So exactly. So if it's an acetylcholine, you know, the nerve coming down in the muscle fiber, releasing transmitters, and if you have more enzyme in there, particularly, it might be chewing it up before it got to the receptor. Or maybe, as Barros was just mentioning, maybe other cells around it, like the glial cells, maybe they're taking it up quickly and you're not getting enough, you know, on there. Or maybe there's, like we said before, something that might be buried on the receptors, but then we should see that variation all the time, right, while we're recording. The point is that these diagrams that you see in your textbook or what we showed you up here, they're very simplified, right? This cell isn't just with this one synapse. It's like the neuromuscular junction. There are many synapses on it at once. When you stimulate the nerve, you're measuring response from many synapses. And the quantum responses are from many of those So maybe if you start to think about the branching here, maybe the synapses are different somehow, right? So we've been through this little scenario, which is kind of fun to go through and think about these different terms. So let's look at this one. We have a synapse that's not saturated. The receptors are not saturated. A large synapse, a large postsynaptic array. So we get a nice quantal response, right? Well, what if we had a vesicle that was really packaged up really well and it fused and made a fusion pore for a little while and saturated that receptor array? Would we see something that went above the other one? Maybe. But it might actually even kind of blunt it out, right? Because it saturated all those receptors. It's an idea. It's a theory you can work on. And so you might see something a little bit different from your control that we started with. Okay? Maybe the vesicle is not fusing directly over the middle of the synapse. Maybe it's off-center, right? So you're not getting all the response from the transmitter. But the same amount of transmitters being released. So you can come up with lots of different ideas. Think about now the synaptic size is different. So above we have a large synapse, right? And it's not saturated. But this synapse happens to be small. And the same amount of transmitters released. So this one's saturated and that one's not. So we're going to get a smaller response for this one and a normal response for that one, right? It's kind of like this synapse over here might be a developing synapse. And this one's an established synapse, right? Your neuromuscular junctions on your skeletal muscles are always kind of pulling back and regrowing, pulling back and regrowing. It's not static. They're always changing a little bit. Right? So maybe, could even be different size vesicles, possibly. Or maybe that drug that you gave that particular person changed somehow the vesicle formation. Maybe they fused together. Or something's different, right? So if you had different size vesicles, they could contain different amounts of transmitter. So it's still a quantum, it's still a single vesicle, but you're having different responses because of maybe the packaging or the size of the vesicle. So what happens if you repetitively stimulate over time? Your nerve, right? You tire out, you fatigue. Is that fatigue due to nerve fatigue, or is it due to muscle fatigue, say, if you're running, or you're thinking too hard on this whole project, going back to Bernard Katz's time, and your brain's getting tired, you know, what is fatigue there? Is it synaptic responses, or is it glucose or something else, right? So maybe if you had a high output, you're stimulating all the time, think of the vesicle fuses, releases transmitter, pinches off, has to recycle, package back up again, fuse, package, you know, and if you're doing that really fast, right, maybe you don't have enough time to fill that vesicle. So is there a time dependence for refilling that you might over time, if you're repetitively stimulating at a high frequency, that you start to get smaller quantal responses? How could you test this in your model preparations, like a fly or a crayfish? When you're right over the neuromuscular junction, you could do that, right? You could test these kind of things. This is what some people do. All right. Also, there are these vesicles that we showed you in that synaptic picture, right, that transmission electron microscopy, where vesicles are not always right at the presynaptic face. Some of those vesicles are higher up in the synapse. Why are they way up there? Those are what's referred to as reserve pool of vesicles. So maybe you're depleting this, stimulating really fast, and they're getting, you know, kind of tired out here in a sense. They can't package so quickly. It's known that high-frequency stimulation can actually induce vesicles that are farther away from the synapse to start to come to the synapse. Or in some cases, modulators can actually work through a second messenger cascade and cause the vesicles to start to come to the synaptic face and dock. And then you could recruit those. But those haven't been used yet, right? So these are like new vesicles. They haven't been used in this high-frequency stimulation. So all of a sudden, wham, you start to get these fresh new vesicles to come in. So what are you going to get? Depression, and then start to get some bigger quantal responses. Right? So that would be kind of neat. How would you explain it otherwise, right? All of a sudden you have this kind of this mix. You got small quantal responses, but then all of a sudden you started getting, you know, the normal quantal responses and mixed in with small ones. So small, big, small, big, small, big, you know, all mixed in. And the idea that people have postulated is it's this reserve pool of vesicles. Now they've actually done imaging studies where you can actually image vesicle pools that take up dye, and you can actually see that these pools move around. So it's kind of cool. But remember, these vesicles are only about 45 nanometers in diameter. You can't see it with your eye. You can't see it even with light microscopy very well. Even with confocal microscopy,
but you can kind of see a pool. But it's very hard to resolve a single vesicle. You basically have to do it with electron microscopy. But remember, that's static. You have to fix your preparation, slice it, and then look at it in an electron microscope, and it's a long process. So you're doing many preparations under different times of your experiment, fix, 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 you know, as you're stimulating, and then comparing different synapses. It's not the same one, so you have to do a lot to look at variability in your preparations to try to make an understanding process of this.
How did you say that those are signaling to come down?
So some depends on the preparation. So the question was, how are these signals to come down to the synapse? Under high-frequency stimulation, for example. They know that calcium can trigger second messenger cascades, like calcium calmodulin kinase. And when that kinase, what does the kinase do? Phosphorylates. The synapsins that hold this vesicle in here, when the synapsin's phosphorylated, it can come off the synapsin. And then phosphorylation processes actually cause vesicles to fuse. That's another phosphorylated dependent step. That was that Nobel Prize in 2000 by Paul Greengard. That got some of those ideas about the phosphorylation. So calcium is a key mechanism. Cyclic AMP is another one. So with high frequency stimulation, you can actually induce a higher level of cyclic AMP, which then can trigger lots of different cascades, for example. Protein kinase A is another one that has been activated and shown to be important for pulling vesicles down. And then modulators like serotonin and some preparations can actually work through second messenger cascades like phospholipase C and actually cause phosphorylation steps and cause vesicles to fuse to the synaptic membrane, or dock, I should say, the synaptic membrane, to be responsible for calcium. So great question. It depends. It's not a given answer because it's preparation dependent. And that's what really confused the literature for a long time, because they would find one thing in one preparation, another thing in another preparation, and they were contradicting each other, like cyclic AMP is not necessary in this one, but it is in this one, or phospholipase C is important in this one, but not that preparation. So now people are much more open-minded that there's lots of different ways that these reserve pool vesicles can come down to the synapse. Okay. So let's think about this. Also, people have found something really unique. When you look at the neuromuscular junction, like this schematic, and you record with a focal electrode right over the nerve terminal, you might get this response. But you do an intracellular recording, the muscle fiber kind of farther away, and then you see this, you see the depolarization, right? So this is the current coming into the muscle fiber here, and this is the depolarization kind of farther away from the synaptic space, and you see it. But then the next time you stimulate again, or you see a response, you get this response, and then all of a sudden you see this tiny little thing, and you wonder, what on earth is happening? So this has been termed missing quantum, because you don't really see it like you did all the time. So sometimes you don't get these, and you wonder, what does that do to? What could happen that you'd have missing quantum? Any ideas that you might have? Missing quantum, you're going to get the Nobel Prize, next Nobel Prize. Bio 535, right? Figure this out. What could be the mechanism behind this? Well, what is this measured from? This is measured from the plasma membrane, right? This is the current that came in this preparation into these receptors, and now it's traveling, right? The depolarization. Remember the tattoo that everybody should have. Instead of butterfly tattoos, you should get I equals B over R along with the Nernst equation. You know, that'd be a better tattoo to get. Nerd tattoos. Okay. So what happens if you redid this? The current is the current that's flowing in, right? And if we relook at this, equals voltage. This is the voltage you're measuring over here across the plasma membrane. Well, if your current's always the same from the vesicle fusion, what might be changing here? Resistance, right? Sorry, this is I equals B over R for those in the front that can't see this. Ohm's law. So what does this resistance do to? Well, if you look at some of these synapses in like a nerve terminal, you can see this nerve terminal here are synapses. And this is just one little swelling on a nerve terminal, like an insect nerve terminal or a crustacean nerve terminal. And you see the synapses vary in size. So everything we talked about, quantal variation, ooh, that really holds true, right? Because you have different size synapses already.
And so that could be an issue. But then, if you look at it with electron microscopy, and I know it's a little hard to see in here, if you look at these, this is a crayfish neuromuscular junction, but these are exciters, and in a crayfish you can actually have inhibitors that release GABA. This is releasing glutamate. And what you see here is this is a muscle fiber. These are contractile elements, myofibrils. If you look at an enlargement of this, what do we see here? We see a nerve terminal, an exciter. We see vesicles here, little vesicles in mitochondria. But what do you see around this? All these little invaginations. This is the plasma membrane of the muscle fiber. So if you release one vesicle here, and you're monitoring way, 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 way over here, you're measuring across that membrane, well, what happened to the current that went through there? Now that membrane depolarization has to travel. You know, or maybe you measured one that was over here, one vesicle fused right there, and now it has to go, you know, that membrane that you're measuring way over here, right? So the idea is that the missing quantum might be due to the subsynaptic reticulum, what they refer to as a subsynaptic reticulum, because you can actually have the cable properties where you lose the potential, just like a wire. You know, if you put a 5 volts of current injected in a wire here and you measure it across the street, way over there, do you get the same, you know, current across there? No, because the resistance of the wire, you've lost some of that current, right? This is why you have booster stations throughout the city, too, the electric lines. It's the same idea here. You've lost the potential because the leak across that membrane, plus the resistance that you had to go through to get there. So this idea of depending on the arrangement of the synapse in the plasma membrane might account for these missing quanta. How do you think they might have addressed this? If you had $1 million, what might you do? What preparation might you use? How could you vary the subsynaptic reticulum? What makes up the subsynaptic? This is the nerve coming to the muscle fiber. In early development in your muscles, for example, too, it's just on top. But then the muscle membrane, the plasma membrane, starts to change its shape to handle the synapses, just like it does in your brain, too. But it's kind of interesting, all this invagination of the membrane. Much more prevalent in the invertebrates like the crayfish and Drosophila. So what they did in Drosophila, they came up with a mutation where you don't really have much of this infolding of the membrane, and the nerve terminal just sits up on the top. So it kind of sits on the top without much of the infoldings. And your guess is as good as mine. What do you think they found for missing quanta? More or fewer? Fewer. So it made a pretty good prediction that the enhanced synaptic subsynaptic reticulum was responsible for missing these quanta. So again, that comes to a problem of what? Quantifying synaptic transmission, where you're taking your measurements, right? Because you just saw how you got problems with your synapse. So there's a lot of interesting aspects to synaptic transmission and trying to understand what's going on. Let's look at this slice here of the cerebellum. And Dr. Debsky will probably talk a lot more about this later on. But there's a very interesting neuron in the cerebellum. It's called the Purkinje cell. It's shown here, named after the guy that described me. And here we're just staining up one, but just think of them all around here in this layer in the cerebellum. So these are cells that receive input in this direction. So it's really, it's like your hand. It's very planar in arrangement. And then input comes on those dendrites up there, those little spines and dendritic branches. And then the output comes down this axon and goes to other parts in the brain. And this is actually very important for your coordination of moving your digits and understanding coordination in your body. This is where this locus takes place. So if we look at this, cell a little bit more enlarged, look at that tree. And then you turn it on its side, and you can see how planar it is compared to your hand this way or that way. So we're going to record in this cell body here, and we're going to quantify synaptic transmission of, say, what are called parallel fibers that come in here. We're going to stimulate this track of neurons that come into this dendritic tree, and we're going to quantify how strong that synapse is in this rat model, let's say, and understand why this rat isn't having very good coordination. Maybe there's something wrong with the synapses in the cerebellum. You know, we want to understand what's wrong. Or maybe there's something abnormal in the structure. So you're going to stab the cell body and
underdo your experiments, right? But what's the problem again with the minis coming from all over, right? But maybe after you do a number of preparations, you could begin to pick up some difference. But it's hard to understand a particular synapse, like right here on that little tip, when you're recording over here in this big array, right? It literally is like a needle in a haystack, right? But this is the way they do things. And, you know, it's one approach. You have to start somewhere, and it's always being modified. Some ways of analysis are actually looking at this a lot more in depth. You're taking these quantal events, like this one, and I flipped it upside down, the current, so it's easier to measure the positive areas and negative areas. And look, you can find out the time it takes. Here's your stimulus artifact. Here's your beginning of your quantal event. So a single vesicle, right? What makes it rise up so sharply? Think. A vesicle fuses to the membrane. Boom. Transmitter release. What do we have here? Receptors. They open up. They all open. Current flows in really quick, right? Sodium current, most of the cases. Sodium flows in. So if it was down, right, sodium would be in. So sodium flows in. Why does it have this gradual decay? Why does the quantal response have the decay it does? Why isn't it like, you know, square? Or why isn't it sharp decay? Why does it have that tail to it?
Random activation.
Inactivation could be.
Yeah, the sodium channels like have exposed and then inactivated.
So maybe like a refractory period. These could be glutamate receptors that open up, you know, or maybe acetylcholine receptors like your nicotinic receptors, and you're on the right point, exactly. So when they open, what happens? Why don't they stay open? Well, remember the transmitter has to come off, right? What makes the transmitter come off? Why doesn't it just stay bound? What makes it come off? So you had a vesicle fused and transmitters there and stuck to your synapse. What makes it come off the synapse? Why doesn't it just stay on those receptors? Isn't that wild? It's wild. Think about it. What happens? So it's kind of like what we were talking about with other channels. These are proteins. So when the transmitter binds to that, it might change its conformation, become an ion channel like that these glutamatergic synapses are your acetylcholine receptors, and it opens up. It changes its conformation. But think of it, just like that voltage-gated sodium channel, it continues to change its conformation. And it goes through a state like desensitization. It's not as sensitive to the glutamate anymore, and the binding affinity changes. And now it's not so strongly attracted to the glutamate, so the glutamate starts to come off. Wow, that's pretty cool, isn't it? And so the idea is that as they're changing their conformation and not responding to that glutamate anymore, glutamate's coming off, but what's the problem? Glutamate's still in the synapse, maybe it could go over to the other synapse and bind on the other synapse, or neighboring receptors. So there is a problem with rebinding phenomenon in synapses where they're worried about high output and maybe this synapse and glutamate coming out and actually spilling over. It's called spillover to other synapses that weren't even activated initially, right? So that could be an issue. But what keeps that from happening normally? What happens to that glutamate after it goes into the synaptic cleft, like in your brain? Taken up into glial cells, right, in your brain. At the neuromuscular junction in the crayfish or the Drosophila, it's taken back up in the nerve terminal. They don't have the glia around it, but it's taken back up very quickly in the nerve terminal. So what could you do to maybe test that? Drugs. Use it, not those kind of drugs. But use drugs that actually block the uptake. And when you do that, you actually find a different decay constant to the shape of this quantal event. So that's kind of interesting. There are some drugs that you can use that actually inhibit desensitization. So if you inhibit desensitization, what's going to happen to this current trace? It's going to become broader, right? And you get a stronger response. Think of what would happen if you did that on the evoked responses, right? You'd have a stronger response. So if you wanted to enhance synaptic transmission, for example. And some of these drugs are medicinal, taken from plants. Isn't that interesting? So they found out a lot of these from plants. When people eat some of these herbal things, they find out, hey, they're kind of chilled out, you know? And they find out what's happening, and it's actually working on these synapses, and sometimes working right on the receptors. So it's kind of interesting to think about what some of these herbal things, what are they doing mechanistically at a synaptic level? And, you know, there's lots of folklore with lots of these things. So you can think of better ways. You can think of peak amplitude, time to peak, decay constant, which is tau, you know, the decay of 63%, maybe the area under the curve, and amplitude's way to quantify these. We've been very involved in that ourselves in the lab over the years. And it's kind of interesting because you can come up with some other measures that were thought of back at the time of Gnard-Cass. So M, remember M, the little M? Another tattoo you can get. Little M equals N times P. So M, we said, was mean guanyl content, right? N is the number of sites that vesicles fuse. And P is the probability of vesicle fusion. Pretty cool. Because just having mean guanyl content, you want to know, well, how many sites are activated? You know, and then if you can figure out that, then you know the probability of vesicle fusion at those sites. So now you can quantify this a little bit more. And you can find out that some synapses have a higher probability than other synapses, even though the number of sites they might fuse are the same. And this is kind of the difference between phasic neuromuscular junctions and tonic neuromuscular junctions in your own body. So it's kind of interesting. This is the difference between synaptic differentiation and the mechanism behind those differences, right? And you want to be able to quantify. So now you can quantify, is P changing, is M changing, are they both changing? And so you're defining it a little bit more and more. So when you hear these terms in the literature, you'll know what is meant by that. And this is used in the pharmaceutical world, too, to understand synaptic function. Okay, we're just about to wrap up here. If you're interested, this is my little plug, we are actually working on a citizen science project where we are actually recording synaptic responses from Drosophila and crayfish preparations, doing quantum recordings, putting those up online, and we now have high school students in Lexington that are actually help beta testing, reading through the protocols to make sure they understand it, in Louisville at Dunbar and DuPont Manual. And now, those files that they first look at the procedures, we put those data up, and people in Kazan, Russia, Padova, Italy, Seoul National University in Korea, and Seoul Military Academy, did I ever say Padova, Italy, and in Iraq, in Erbil, Iraq, and now we just have another person in Brazil, San Pablo, Brazil, and a person in Leipzig, Germany, where Gnard-Cass came from, just to let you know. And I wrote to that student and said, "How do you have a statue of Gnard-Cass?" And they said, "Well, why would we have that?" They did not know that Gnard-Cass came from their university, like Thomas Hunt Morgan here, right? And I said, "You should have this." But he left during the war time when the Nazis were in there. He's a German Jewish person. He left, and he went to Australia. Then he went back to England, and he did a lot of his found work. But if you're interested, you can go to this website, and we're actually doing this, and people are adding to the literature. They're doing synaptic transmission, mean quantum contact. And they're actually doing this, and what we hope to do is, if one group is having differences, why are you having a difference in your analysis than this person? So we're already doing peer-reviewed studies by ourselves. So when we go to publish it, we've already gone through the peer-reviewed and addressed all the problems, why you might have differences in the synapses. And we're having these people suggest experiments that we can now do in the lab that they might not be able to do with Drosophila. We can now do that experiment and then put the data back up in line for people to analyze. So if you're game, just check out the website, email. All right, all that's posted, and I will post the podcast. Sorry, Echo screwed up, but at least you got a podcast.